On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I am Jeff Taylor, your moderator, and it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest. Jacob J. Lew is the 76th Secretary of the Treasury. He previously served as White House Chief of Staff. Prior to that role, he was Director of the Office of Management and Budget, a position he also held in President Clinton's cabinet from 1998 to 2001. In 2010, Mr. Lew first joined the Obama administration as Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, the Honorable Jacob J. Lew. So let's start with a question fresh from the news. After a very promising 2013 that featured a lot of growth, especially employment growth, we've seen some slowing and some disappointing job reports lately. As Treasury Secretary, you also pay close attention to tax receipts. What are those telling you about the outlook for the economy that we're not seeing in the economic data?
Well, first, thank you for moderating today, Jeff, and thank you to the World Affairs Council and Peter for hosting. I look forward to this conversation. I think if you look at the economy, we ended 2013 quite strong, and we entered 2014 for the first time in a long time with some tailwinds, with things moving in the right direction. Economic indicators are going to bounce around a little bit, and I think we have to kind of resist the temptation to run too much with each individual piece of news. If you look at the overall kind of arc of the economic data over the last half year, it's been pretty positive. It's shown strength in manufacturing, strength in construction. It's shown a resilient growth rate that's climbing. We're going to have different pieces of data that from time to time, but I think you really have to look over a period of time to see the real trajectory. It's a little early to have a sense of what tax receipts are going to be like. The experience historically is that the early returns are tax refunds, and we don't tend to see the returns that come with checks until a little bit later in the season.
Mm-hmm. This week actually marked the fifth anniversary of the stimulus program, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Can you talk about that 5 years on? What effect did it have? What's been the lingering impact?
You know, Jeff, I think that the strong response in 2008 and 2009, the Recovery Act, combined with the steps that were taken through financial reform, really showed the resilience of the American economy and our ability to come back from the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. If you look at the kind of numbers, the Recovery Act either created or avoided the loss of 6 million jobs. If you look around our country, there's work to show for it in improved infrastructure, roads, and improved technology systems. And if you look at that combined with fixing our financial system, which we also celebrated the fifth anniversary of the Dodd-Frank Act recently, we took quicker and stronger action than other countries did. And the result is that we have a growth rate that is doing better than other countries. We're going to talk in a few minutes, I think, about some of the things that we'll be doing when I go to the G20 meetings in Australia. But frankly, we're going to be saying others need to learn a little bit from our experience and need to do a little bit more to kind of get their economies moving, to get demand growing and growth higher. And they need to do more in terms of financial reforms and financial standards. Because I think what we've seen is that when you do that in our system, it has real results. Now, that's not to say our job is finished. There's a lot more work to do. We will not be satisfied as long as there are Americans looking for work who can't find it, as long as we see kind of growing disturbing patterns of inequality. We're a country where there has to be equal opportunity for all, and we're a country where we don't make the decision that everybody has to have the same outcome, but everybody has a chance to an education, a chance to a good job, a chance to make a contribution. And we're going to keep our shoulder to the wheel for the next 3 years, so we're not doing a victory lap. But I think you look at the record of this country over the last 5 years, and we are stronger both economically and in terms of facing future economic challenges because of these efforts.
You mentioned the G20 finance ministers meeting. I know you're flying to Australia later today to go to that. I don't think it's unfair to say there's been anxiety internationally about the debt ceiling limit and getting that raised. It was done, you know, relatively easily this time. So having accomplished that, what do you think some of the pressing issues are?
Well, I'm delighted to be able to go off to these meetings with that resolved because, frankly, the budget battles, the shutdown of the government, the self-inflicted wound of a crisis overextending our borrowing authority, they diminished our ability to make our case in the world, and now we can show that while our process may have been a little bit messy, we have gotten over that period of kind of stalemate. Mm. And we're, you know, while maybe it shouldn't be something that we find remarkable that we can do the regular business in an orderly way, it's a lot better than not doing the regular business in an orderly way. And I think having the, you know, debt limit resolved is a good thing. I would say for our economy, it's a good thing as well because it provides a kind of certainty. We're not, you saw in December a budget agreement that was a two-year budget agreement, which is important. It shows that we're going to be able to, you know, fund the government in an orderly way for 2 years. We saw an appropriation bill that implemented real policies. A few of the policies that were in the appropriation bill are actually part of the core agenda to grow the economy. You know, things like, you know, funding for Tiger Grants to have transportation hubs that help grow our economy. Funding for manufacturing centers to bring together businesses and schools to make sure that we provide workers with the skills that businesses need to locate and technology businesses need to advance. There was funding for early childhood education, for things that, you know, that's the way you really make sure we have the workers the economy needs 20 years from now, not just 20 months from now. So you look at the pattern from a budget agreement in December to an omnibus appropriation bill in January, a farm bill that was kind of locked up in a political dispute for years, resolved, and now the debt limit done in an orderly way. I think it actually gives you an ability to be optimistic that over the next 3 years, we're going to see more and more business that can be done to advance the interests of the American people and the American economy. When I go to the G20, what we're going to be focusing on is really the kind of core agenda of economic growth and how do you get demand growing in every part of the world, ranging from, you know, Europe to Asia to, you know, the steps that countries can take and that we collectively can take to make sure that there's an environment where growth is more robust than it is today. And we're seeing recovery. I mean, Europe is growing at a low level, but it's a lot better than a recession. We've seen Japan make progress, you know, after almost 15 years of economic stagnation and deflation. You know, we're seeing, you know, China face the real difficult decisions for economic reforms that they need to be competitive in the future, but struggling to keep their growth rate in the short term high. And, you know, I think in each of these cases, there are policies that can enhance the chance of doing better. We're going to be proudly advocating policies that we think are good, not just for the United States, but good for the world to grow demand. I think on the financial front, we did a lot in this past 5 years, even in the past year that I've been secretary, to put financial reforms in place to make our financial system safer for the American people and for the world. We have challenges still to harmonize systems around the world at the high level that the U.S. now is meeting in so many areas. That will be a big part of our agenda as well. You know, I look forward to conversations. It's always challenging because countries come with different perspectives. And, you know, we obviously will be responding to issues of concern to other countries as well as raising issues that we think should be the center of the discussion.
To keep the focus abroad for a moment, there are negotiations going on in Vienna this week around a comprehensive agreement with Iran on its nuclear weapons. Some companies, perhaps getting a little ahead of themselves, have started to send trade delegations to that country. Do you have any message for those companies?
You know, Jeff, I have been very clear, and more importantly, the president's been very clear. Iran is not open for business. The Joint Plan of Action provided very specific, very limited, very time-limited relief from specific sanctions, but it left in place the core oil and financial sanctions, which make anyone doing business with Iran violating those sanctions subject to enforcement actions. I have made clear when I was at the World Economic Council in Davos I made clear after President Rouhani gave a speech there that we were going to watch who was doing business and take action if there were violations of sanctions. And I think when the president spoke to the issue last week, he put it more simply that we're going to come down like a ton of bricks if people violate the sanctions. So I think that what we've seen is sanctions work. Sanctions have gotten the government of Iran to focus on the need to change its policy, and the joint plan of action is a step in the right direction. But it is not the final resolution of these issues. It is a narrowly crafted amount of relief of sanctions mm-hmm. for specific steps to step back from some of the actions that they're taking in the nuclear area. If the final agreement does not come about in an acceptable way, we would put more sanctions in place
yep.
and take other actions if necessary. One last point I'd make is that when you look at the amount of sanctions relief, the impact of the sanctions that remain in effect are far greater in 6 months than the amount of relief given. It's about $7 or so billion of relief, but $30 billion of ongoing impact. Hmm. So the pressure on Iran's economy will continue. It is not going to be relieved less than until there's an acceptable resolution of these negotiations.
Ukraine, big disruptions, much unrest in Ukraine. What is the proper role for the United States to play? What kind of response are you mustering?
Jeff, the president's made clear that the violence in the streets are unacceptable and that we are looking at what actions, if any, we can take to hold people accountable for violence there. But I think if you look at the core of what's going on in Ukraine from the perspective that I'm principally responsible for, the economy, at the core they have an economic crisis, and they're going to need to deal with it. And the mechanism that's best for Ukraine to deal with it would be to come to the IMF and to have a package where they put in place economic reforms, where they get the support that they need in exchange for the steps to fix their economy. I need to note that the United States has a leading role in the IMF since its creation. We have a veto power at the IMF on important issues, and we are the leading voice in many ways at the IMF. One of the things that we need to do is to ratify IMF reforms that were agreed to in 2010. We were disappointed in January that Congress did not ratify those reforms. I think this is another lesson of how important it is for the United States to have the tools to engage in an effective way, and we're certainly going to go back to make the case to Congress that those IMF reforms need to be approved.
Obviously an issue of interest here in the Bay Area is business tax reform. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is that a priority? Can we make progress on that?
I'm of the view that business tax reform is one of those areas where if you look at the positions taken by different parties, there's reason to think that there could be a coming together because there's a convergence of thinking on the kind of central issues, on the need to eliminate a lot of the distortions that come from deductions and exclusions, to lower the statutory rates so that we're not at 35%, but that we're closer to the world average, to have a system for recognizing income from international earnings that doesn't create an incentive for countries to create offshore entities to avoid U.S. Taxation. And I think these are all things that are important to creating a magnet for investment in the United States. When you look at the investment environment in the United States, we've got a lot going for us. We've got the best workers in the world. We've got the best infrastructure, which we need to put more into to make sure it stays that way. We've got the most stable political system, notwithstanding the noise from time to time. We have abundant and affordable energy resources. Our tax system ought to be part of that magnet. It ought not to be pushing investment away. The president in July made some remarks on this subject that, frankly, I think people should listen to again. He said, why don't we, if we can't agree on all of tax reform, can't agree necessarily on individual tax reform, if there's a convergence of thinking on business tax reform, why don't we move ahead on business tax reform? And why don't we take the one-time savings that come from making a transition and take those savings and plow them into infrastructure and solve two problems at the same time? I think that's an idea which the more people think about it, the more attractive it's going to get. So we're going to keep working on it. We're going to keep pushing. We certainly hope that this next couple of years, a time when we can get that done.
So I want to introduce a few questions from the audience.
Sure.
Because I have a number of questions. Seems like there's an enthusiastic response. A few of them pertain to China. It seems like people here want to hear you talk about China. So how do you see China's journey toward creating an open economy and an open market system continue, given the realities of politics in China? It's still a communist system. It's wary about many things, and yet it's increasingly vital to the world's economic functioning. Can you talk a little bit about where you see that journey going?
Sure. Yeah. I've spent a lot of time over this past year engaging with my Chinese counterparts. They had a new government take over just around the time I became secretary, so we kind of were we assumed our roles at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I have the impression, having been there right after the new government was formed and right as they were completing their plenum where they announced a policy for the next number of years, I'm convinced that they understand they need economic reforms, that the kinds of market-oriented reforms that we advocate, the market determination of the exchange rate, market determinate allocation of capital, taking away the props for state-owned enterprises, having there be international competition in their marketplace. I think they understand the need for that, not for our well-being, but to have the long-term environment for economic growth that they need in China. They see around them the evidence of miscalculations in state allocation of resource. Mm-hmm. They see it in empty buildings, and they see it in unsold inventory. They understand the economic case, but as your question suggests, they're deeply rooted in their own tradition, which they're not going to jump over and become a kind of mini United States. So the question is, how do they evolve towards more market-oriented economic system while maintaining their communist structure? I think this is going to be a challenge, but I actually think at the core of it is the challenge of how do they make change, which is by its basic nature disruptive, in a way that maintains stability at a social and political level. So while I'm persuaded that they understand the direction of change, I'm cautious about predicting the speed of change. And I think that we will be pushing hard for those changes to come quicker and for them to be more clear, that it's not enough to hang a banner in Shanghai and say Shanghai is a free trade zone. You have to enumerate where the Shanghai market will be open to international competition. It's not enough to say that you're going to engage in a binational investment treaty that reverses a presumption that their markets are closed to the presumption that their markets are open, but then not list any of the areas that are open. Mm-hmm. I could go through many examples. The exchange rate, you can't have the goal of becoming a world reserve currency unless you have a market-determined exchange rate. So these are all things that I believe they see they need to do, and we're going to keep pushing to do it faster. Yeah. Because it's not just impatience. It's important for the world economy. I think for China to have the stable, robust growth that it needs is important to the world economy. You look at where global growth is right now, and if the United States is successful and manages to grow around 3%, a little under, a little over, it's not going to pull up. If China slips a percentage from where it should be, yeah. It's not going to make up for Europe if it slips a half a percent or percent from where it should be. We can't be an engine that pulls the whole world along. The whole world is going to have to grow more. And for China, that's going to require more efficient market determination of economic signals.
Hmm. Like me, some people in the audience seem interested in the Bitcoin phenomenon. I have a couple of questions about that here. Can you talk about that? I mean, is the U.S. considering any kind of regulatory action to curb Bitcoin's use? Are you concerned about it?
Well, I think first of all, the whole idea of virtual currency is kind of on a continuum from the traditional regulated banking world to cash, and it's somewhere in the middle. We've seen the development of online payment systems that have shown how much the friction can be reduced in online transactions mm-hmm. through a safe medium. I think the question with anything, whether it's cash or virtual currency, is really the same. We have a set of rules that govern what is kind of legal and illegal behavior. So, things like financing illicit activities in drugs or in threat financing are just as illegal if you do it in the banking system with cash or with virtual currency. Hmm. Obviously, it's easier to see in the banking system. It's hardest to see in cash. And, we're learning our way around virtual currencies, and we saw in the kind of Silk Road prosecution action taken against a misuse of a virtual currency. So I don't think it's a question of kind of special rules necessarily. It's a question of how do you apply the rules that are cross-cutting in a way that reflects the introduction of a new technology. And the development of settlement systems in this country, whether it's clearinghouses or credit cards, has really happened in the private sector. It's happened through innovation, and each one creates kind of new challenges to make sure that we have a level playing field in terms of oversight. And I think our teams that work on this have been quite effective in trying to keep up with the new technologies.
Since we're on the topic of new technologies, the skills gap is a kind of a persistent concern, especially here in Silicon Valley. I know there are many other industries nationally where that's an issue too, but here the issue is the availability of talent, engineering talent, to build the next technologies. Can you talk a little bit about that? What kind of training and retraining should federal policy be supporting, or should the president be supporting?
Well, Jeff, it has been at the core of what we have been arguing we need to do to improve the opportunities for individuals to have access to middle-class jobs, but also to improve the vitality of the American economy. And I think one has to look at it in stages because there's a short and a long-term perspective. Obviously, in the very short term, if an employer needs people with certain skills, there are things we can do in the short term. We have some of the best, we have the best universities in the world. Yeah. We have a community college system that has an ability to train people for specific skills with great agility. If a community college knows that there are some basic skills that are needed in the local economy, we've seen in manufacturing centers where they team together and they create programs and train people, and they're virtually guaranteed employment when they get the certificates. I think that there's a longer-term way of thinking about it that starts with early childhood education, goes through elementary and secondary education by strengthening our science, technology, engineering, and math programs, and it goes all the way through college and graduate school in terms of promoting the kind of skills training so that we keep being at the cutting edge of innovation, but we also produce the workers to execute the policies on a day-to-day basis. I think if you look at the introduction of technology into our society, it's really creating an enormous need for people with technical skills, but the ability to think across disciplines and to be the ones who make the system actually work. I think that there is going to be real opportunity in the United States here. Because you look at the stability of our system, you look at all the benefits I was describing earlier. Yep. If we're able to generate the workforce of the future, I think there'll be more and more investment in the United States. When I talk to CEOs, they raise two or three issues with me as to what they think are the kind of building blocks you need to put investments into the United States. One is skills training, and I think that is kind of fundamentally a public responsibility because there's so much public investment from primary and secondary education all the way through community colleges and state universities. Mm-hmm. And we do well there. We need to do better. There's infrastructure. They worry deeply about will the roads be adequate, will the ports be adequate for the shipping that comes and goes. And they see us falling behind, that we're not doing the things you would do to be guaranteed of the kind of infrastructure you'd want 5 and 10 years from now. Mm. And the third, frankly, is immigration reform. It's how do we maintain the workforce? And we have so many people who get educated in this country. You look at the DREAM Act kids. They come here, you know, as children. They grow up as Americans. You know, we're putting, you know, everything our system can offer into giving them an education. But, you know, until we were able to take action to avoid having them be deported, they weren't able to go to work. We have people in this country that we train come in from overseas who want to stay and work here, and we don't let them. You know, the question of do you staple a green card to a diploma is a serious question. But more broadly, immigration reform is part of what's created the vitality of entrepreneurship in this country mm-hmm. and the ongoing recreation of the most vital workforce in the world. And I think immigration reform is something that we need to get to.
Well, Speaker Boehner's been pretty clear about what he thinks the prospects are for immigration reform in this Congress, and he's not super optimistic about it. Here in Silicon Valley, in a related topic, there's a big concern around HB1 visas. Silicon Valley, I don't know if you hear this from the tech execs that you talk to, but when we speak to them, they say, let's take that out of the broader immigration reform push, not that we disagree with, you know, the need for a comprehensive immigration settlement, but HB1 visas are a separate issue. We need to be able to hire the best workers, whether they're from Korea or India or Indiana. Is there anything you can tell our audience about that?
I would say that the economic case for immigration reform is very strong, and I find it very hard to separate the issues. I mean, I think when immigration reform happens, there should be provisions that address that issue.
Yeah.
But it ought to be more fundamental than that. You look at immigration reform, and it is unquestionably going to grow the economy and grow our tax base and help us deal even with our demographic issues and Social Security and Medicare financing. And at some very fundamental level, it's who we are as people. And so my personal view is that they're kind of inextricably connected, but we should get on with it and do it.
Mm. I have a number of questions here about quantitative easing, fiscal policy, so I'll try one there. Some economists say that the Fed should end QE funding sooner than is presently contemplated and point to the fact that banks are still a little reluctant to lend even though they have federal money on their balance sheets from that program. Can you talk about that? What do you think about the progress of quantitative easing and the pulling back on it?
Well, as I think you probably know, Jeff, there's a long-established tradition that Treasury secretaries don't comment on monetary policy, I've honored that and will continue to honor that tradition.
Okay.
But I will say a word or two about kind of the core economic issues. You know, our Federal Reserve Board, central banks around the world focus on how is a core economy doing? Is growth continuing on a sustainable basis? Is unemployment coming down and getting to levels that reflect more normal levels of employment opportunity? And you know, what I focus on every day is can we take action to improve our economy and to create the environment in which anyone looking at our economy will say it's doing better. I think there's no doubt that our economy is stronger now than it was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We have more work to do, and I leave it to the Fed to make decisions about when we're at a point that they determine appropriate for these actions. I know an issue that comes up fairly regularly and is the impact it has on emerging markets.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as I go to the G20, I'm sure we'll be talking about that at that meeting. One of the things that has been very clear to me watching over these last few months as discussions about quantitative easing and taper took over,
yep.
Is that if you focus on the core economies of each of the emerging markets, you see very different results in terms of how they're performing. The countries that have taken decisive action to get their fiscal houses in order
yeah.
and structural reforms to have labor markets work, they're doing differently than countries that have not taken those steps. So I think it comes back, even in the emerging markets, to kind of core fundamentals.
Where do you see that going? I mean, do you think that we've seen the worst of the effect on emerging markets, or do you think that cycle could continue?
Well, I'm not going to attach causality.
Yeah.
I think that if you look over the last few months, the emerging markets that have taken kind of decisive action on whether it's energy reforms or labor market reforms, fiscal policy reforms, tax reforms, they are doing much better than countries that have not. And I think to the extent that there are countries that have more work to do and are in difficult situations because of it, you know, I'll go back to the IMF. There are international ways to deal with helping countries when they enter into programs that put their house in order and they then get some support to bridge. But the critical thing is to make the reforms, and it's another case for the IMF. I mean, the IMF plays an important role in that because it is really the principal first responder.
Tax policy, I have a couple of questions here about tax policy. It boils down to the Obama administration has approached tax policy in specific ways. It hasn't it hasn't changed capital gains rates, but it has made some other tweaks. Is there any interest in the administration in trying to tackle a comprehensive tax reform?
Well, we spoke a little bit earlier about business tax reform.
Yeah.
I think there's a very strong interest. I think that it's we have an inefficient system now that has a high statutory rate and incentives that no longer reflect what policymakers would say we need as an economy. We may have needed them at one point, we may not have, but at the moment, it's skewing economic decisions and leaving us with a high statutory rate that makes this, on the list of countries, look like a very high tax environment. When you look at the average tax rate, because of all the exclusions and deductions, we're closer to the average. But if you're not in one of the favored industries, you don't get the benefit of that lower tax rate, which is why we need to have tax reform. So I don't think there's any question but that we're committed to it. The president put a white paper out. I've engaged with the committees in Congress. Look, it's challenging. I was involved in tax reform in 1986. It was challenging then as well. One thing that is always true in tax reform, anyone who loses a deduction feels it directly and intensely and makes their views known. Mm-hmm. Everyone who benefits from the general improvement of the system is a little bit quieter. And, you know, having a more robust public discussion where the broad beneficiaries of tax reform are heard from more is always good to help focus the political attention on it. Because it's entirely predictable that taking away deductions that exist for one or another industry will elicit, pressure. Look, this is going to be hard. It's always hard to take away tax benefits and to lower rates. But I think we'd create a much more robust economic environment if we did it. I think it does have to be severed, in the short term at least, from individual tax reform, because individual tax reform is inextricably connected to larger fiscal policy questions. You can do business tax reform on a revenue-neutral basis. I don't believe you can do individual tax reform on a revenue-neutral basis. It's part of the broader conversation, which may not be for this year or next, on balancing a fiscal plan for revenue and entitlement reform for the long term. You know, we were ready to do that. There was not an environment in Washington that was ready to do it, and we remain open to it. But I don't think deferring business tax reform makes sense because it's part of getting our economic engine moving.
Speaking of the climate in Washington, the speed with which the debt ceiling deal got done has given some, I think, some sense of at least greater optimism about gridlock. How do you see things going? I mean, the gridlock's been pretty historic, and the president has acknowledged it in his State of the Union speech. Do you see an easing? Do you see a relaxing of gridlock, or does it continue to be a challenge?
Well, look, comparing 2011, 12, and 13 to the last 4 months is a world of difference. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, the attitude in Congress shifted. It shifted from everything is going to be a bitter confrontation, even if it shuts down the government or forces the threat of default, to we need to get this done and move on and deal with other things. Look, I think this is the way government should function. We should also tackle other big issues. You got to build a bit of experience with doing things in a more orderly, regular way. I think the fact that the American people and people around the world are applauding the moves in December, January, and February, mm-hmm. I hope encourages more openness to doing the kinds of things that are challenging but can be accomplished. You know, take infrastructure. I've worked in policy areas like this for better part of four decades. Mm-hmm. It's not a partisan issue. You know, you can have a dispute as to how to pay for roads and bridges, but everyone believes we need to have the kind of infrastructure that will support a vibrant economy.
Yeah.
Immigration reform, I believe there's a majority in both houses that are prepared to do it. I understand it's divisive within, you know, the Republican Party.
Yeah.
You know, there are Democrats who would vote against it also. You have to put a bipartisan consensus together to get things done. I'm not going to be a Pollyanna and say that in the next 3, 6, 9 months, all the hard issues will be addressed. But I think if you look at issues like skills training and infrastructure and immigration reform, tax reform, I think there's a possibility of getting things done over the course of the next couple of years. And, you know, one thing I know for sure is that where we were in 2011 and 12 was not good. It wasn't good for the economy. It wasn't good for the psychology of this country. Mm. There's a reason people were showing weakened confidence. They were nervous. They were worried that their government wasn't functioning. Showing that the government can function is really important. I mean, people depend on it, and their willingness to both spend money and invest in their business is affected by their level of comfort or anxiety. So I actually think that getting back to a kind of regular order will actually be an economic boost. Yeah. If that can become a foundation for working on a bipartisan basis to do a few more hard things, you know, I think people will actually feel proud of their government, and that's a good thing.
Yep. I have a question here about oil and gas production. It's focused around the economic benefit associated with that. I know there are other issues involved there. There's regulatory issues. There's intense heat around fracking. But as an economic matter, can you talk about oil and gas production in the United States and in the West and the effect that it's having?
Well, obviously, it's been very important to us to both develop our fossil fuel resources, but to do it in a way that we believe is environmentally safe and consistent with our principles about protecting our environment. I don't think there's any question but that the development of U.S. energy resources in the last few years has been nothing short of kind of revolutionary in terms of changing the economics of doing business in the United States. We are now an economy that's perceived to have abundant, reliable, you know, moderately priced energy processed fuels.
Mm-hmm.
That's an enormous advantage. When you have you know, the best education system in the world, and you have the you know, availability of domestic energy resources, and you have political conditions that make, you know, individuals and companies comfortable that they can come safely to the United States. There's a lot of countries where people do business where they're not sure what it's going to look like in 5 or 10 years. No one asks that question about the United States. They worried about the brinksmanship. And that, so I think getting beyond that is good, but no one ever questioned fundamentally whether the United States was a safe place to do business, our system of laws and regularity. You know, I think it's a powerful package that makes the United States an attractive place to do business. You know, even as we move through a technological revolution where, you know, computers and you know, technology and production is shifting some of the work from people to you know, machines,
mm-hmm.
that reduces the cost differential doing business in the United States versus countries with much lower wages. And it grows the number of high-quality jobs in the United States. So I think we have to look at all these things as opportunities, because the more we bring business to the United States, the more we grow good jobs in the United States, the more we're going to create those opportunities that close the gaps that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
It is fundamentally about having an economy that's growing fast enough so everyone has a chance. We don't guarantee outcomes in this country, but we should be able to guarantee opportunity.
Income inequality is on my card here, and I will say San Francisco just lately has been kind of a flashpoint for the debate over income inequality. The resurgence, the continuing surge of the technology industry and sort of the reinvention of the way that we live, you know, by that industry has had many byproducts. One of them here is income inequality. There's a lot of anger about it. Is the president concerned? Are you concerned about income inequality, not necessarily here in the Bay Area, but broadly? And is there anything to be done on it about it?
The president has spoken to this issue at great length, and it obviously was very much at the center of the State of the Union this year in terms of talking about making sure that every American has the opportunity to pursue an education and to have access to a middle-class job. There's clearly a challenge ahead of us in the short term. You know, we know that dealing with the minimum wage is a controversial issue.
Yeah.
But we also know that it is just not acceptable to have people work full-time in this country and still live below the poverty line. And raising the minimum wage just to make sure that someone working full-time is at or above the poverty line is a minimal first step. I think if you look at the skills issues we were talking about, it is striking how different the opportunities are for people with a good education versus people without a good education. And you know, the sorting process will continue, and unless you have an education, your chance to really have that opportunity is going to be handicapped. You know, there are other questions that to deal with in the long term in terms of what the impact of technology is. I for one don't believe you can stop the wheels of progress. It wouldn't have worked to stop the steam engine or electricity. And no one could have predicted where the growth and the opportunities were going to come from with any of the things that were really kind of pivot moments in terms of economic growth. There haven't been that many of those inventions in history, and the computer is one of them. I think that there will be new opportunities, but those opportunities will go to people who have the ability to take advantage of them, which is why we have the responsibility to make sure that we provide the tools for people to compete.
I do have a couple of questions here about the minimum wage, and they come at it from a different angle, which I know you know is a political reality. I mean, people are concerned about what's the cost, you know, of raising the minimum wage. If you do raise the minimum wage for more than government workers, if you are successful in doing that, how is that cost absorbed? I mean, does the cost get passed on to the consumer? How do you see it rippling out through the economy? Is it only positive from your point of view?
Look, I think that what's clear is that raising the minimum wage will take a lot of people out of poverty. If whether the number is around 1 million or a little bit higher or a little bit lower, it's a lot of people.
Yep.
And I think at some level that's just something that, consistent with our values, we have to do. I think that over the years there have been a lot of studies of the minimum wage, and the studies that I find most persuasive, mm-hmm. including studies by a number of Nobel laureates, show that economic growth that comes from raising the minimum wage kind of neutralizes any direct impact that the higher wage might have that would impose economic burden. There are other views. I know that this is an area where there are different views. I think it comes back to our core challenge. Our core challenge is making sure we do what we can do for the foundations for economic growth to be strong. Because if we do what we should do in terms of tax policy, in terms of infrastructure policy, in terms of training, and the economy is growing faster, that will more than offset the impact of the minimum wage and create greater opportunities. And instead of trying to hold back the minimum wage, we should be focusing on doing those things that are tangible steps we could take to actually improve the economy.
Here in Silicon Valley, another of the realities that you see among technology companies are huge reserves of cash on the balance sheets of many of these big companies. Apple has billions and billions of dollars in cash. Apple is investing in, it's building fulfillment centers in Texas and Arizona. You know, there's certainly jobs being created, but it has so much more money, and many other technology companies do too. Is there an effect of that? Is that a problem? Is that money on the sideline? Should they do something with it?
I think it's way beyond. It's bigger than just the technology companies. Yeah. We have trillions of dollars that are sitting on the sidelines right now, and a lot of it here in the United States. It's not just a question of income that's overseas. There's a lot of corporate retained earnings that are sitting on the sidelines here in the United States. You know, I think that if we can create a kind of certainty that we're on a steady path in terms of governing and in terms of the economy, that will make a huge difference. Mm. You know, I think that you look at the way the economic recovery in 2011, 2012, 2013 worked. Every time we had a kind of self-inflicted crisis in Washington, it took the steam out of the economic recovery.
Yep.
People kind of retrenched and they were nervous. They didn't know what the timing or the direction of action was going to be, and I think it encouraged people to keep money on the sidelines. I've had a lot of CEOs tell me that. I think that, you know, if the economic news of the last 6 months holds up, and I've talked to a lot of CEOs in the last 2-3 weeks, I'm getting the sense that they're seeing an economy that reflects the characteristics that I've described. You know, no one's going to predict with certainty exactly what the growth rate will be. But I'm not hearing any predictions of it falling way off of the kind of consensus mark.
Yeah.
You know, that will lead to the higher level of confidence in the system, government system working, higher level of confidence that we're on a good economic trajectory. You know, I think will lead to some money coming back from the sidelines. And that's why I think it's actually more important than just the decision on the budget and the debt limit. I mean, it's really part of taking some of that uncertainty away. And it is, you know, it is, I think, going to fundamentally be driven by decisions that CEOs make about both their certainty and their order books. Mm. And if we can get demand, you know, showing that their order books are filling up and certainty that things are headed in the right direction, I think we can see, you know, good growth in this country and good investment.
Speaking of the budget, President Obama is soon going to release his 2015 budget proposal. Will he revive the proposal to curb the earned interest deduction? Are there any other proposals like that?
The earned interest deduction, do you mean carried interest?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. The president, for you know, for a number of years, has seen carried interest as something that should be you know, treated more as income than as investment income. Certainly, when it's a form of income compensation. And I'm not going to say what is and isn't in the budget, but we've taken that position in the past and continue to believe it.
Chinese investors have come to this market, to this country, and are investing in all sorts of assets, real estate in California, for sure. Do you think that signals anything about their confidence or lack of it in investing in China? And what do you think of the trend? Is it a healthy trend? Do you welcome that investment?
We have welcomed foreign direct investment in the United States for all of our history. It has been a source of enormous strength in the United States that we've been seen as a magnet for foreign direct investment. Obviously, you know, there are some exceptions to that if it's in an area that's of real national security or strategic concern. But by and large, I think the United States is seen as a safe haven. And it has been good for the U.S. economy in our history. And you know, one of the reasons it's important not to have fights like the debt limit and will we or won't we pay our bills is, you know, it takes hundreds of years to develop the gold standard reputation. We should never treat it lightly. I mean, it is of real economic benefit in the United States that the, you know, United States dollar and our system is considered the gold standard. Mm.
I have a couple of questions about small business and the Obama administration's commitment to small business. As the stock market soars, are there measures that government should be considering to boost small business? I think sometimes small business people can feel out there on their own a little bit, not necessarily supported by fiscal policy and kind of living close to the street, if you will.
Well, we have tried over the course of the last 5 years through a number of initiatives to make credit available and support available to small business, tax benefits available to small businesses to encourage investment and expansion. We continue to think that small businesses are at the heart of economic growth. As we go through financial reform, having clarity in what the implementation of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reforms are will, I think, lead to an environment where financial institutions feel like they know the rules of the road and they can lend more easily to creditworthy entities, including small business. So I think the things we do directly, the things we do by making the system more accessible, are all going to be important. But fundamentally, we need to make sure that we're growing the economy, because one thing that we've seen over the history in the United States is when there's a good economy in the United States, entrepreneurs and small businesses come in, and they take advantage both of the market opportunities and they take advantage of the things that we can do to help them. You know, when I look at the challenges, say, in Europe, it's really quite striking how differently Europe and we approach you know, the provision of credit and support to small businesses. And I'm frequently pointing to what we do in our tax code and our SBA and in our activities, because they have a very fragmented capital market. There are a lot of countries where small businesses just can't get capital. Mm. In the United States, we're trying to get capital into the hands of small business, and we clearly could do more and could do better, but it's very much important to us.
You mentioned financial regulation and the Dodd-Frank bill. Now that that's in place, what more needs to be done on financial regulation?
You know, I think that we've done an enormous amount over the last 5 years. Our banks are much better capitalized, and that means they have more money available to them if they hit a crisis, mm-hmm. so that they won't need to go to the taxpayer. We have systems in place where our regulators can see what's going on in the banks, in the financial institutions, more clearly. Mm-hmm. We have resolution plans. What happens if an institution fails? Where they, the most significant institutions, have what are called living wills, where they have to say, here's how we would manage our own affairs and not come to the taxpayer. We have a, what we call a single point of entry, where it's a mechanism to go in and divide financial institutions so that you can separate the good from the bad and manage their restructuring. When I look at the challenges, they are in two regards principally. One is the international system, and that's something we'll be talking about at the G20.
Yep.
It's very difficult, as we learned when Lehman collapsed, it's very difficult to put a large financial institution, financial failure,
yep.
within one nation's boundaries. The interconnections between banking systems and economies is just so, there's so much interconnection that you need to be certain of how the resolution will work in other countries as well. It's why having harmonized international standards at a high level that meets ours is so important.
Yep.
And that's one of the issues that we're going to work on. They've made progress in Europe and in Asia on this, but frankly, we've done more. And we applaud the progress they've made, and we encourage further progress. I think the second area is something that is called shadow banking. Kind of non-traditional banking. It's something that is not just a U.S. issue. As I talk to my counterparts around the world,
yep.
it's manifesting itself in many different economies. And it's not that it's bad to have alternate structures come into existence to have capital available and savings opportunities.
Yep.
But when money runs into institutions that, where there's less oversight, less transparency, mm-hmm. less visibility, there's also the potential for more risk. And in the United States, we have taken steps and are taking more steps to deal with that. Internationally, we need to as well. I think we're it's a phenomenon that we're seeing around the world, and that cross-border resolution and dealing with these non-traditional financial institutions are high on the agenda of things to look at in the future.
I think I read that China took some steps to try to curb shadow banking inside its borders. I mean, are there other parts of the world that have farther to go?
Yeah, it's an issue. It's an issue in other parts of the world, and frankly, even our system is something that has international reach because a lot of international banks roll over their holdings on a daily basis in our money market funds. So, if there were a crisis, in any one of our countries, it would have implications internationally. So I think we look at the amount of money that are in these kinds of institutions. It's considerably reduced from the height of the financial crisis, by very substantial amount. But it's still something that, you look at China, you look at Europe, you look at the United States, it's something that there's a lot of focus on.
Yep. Retirement saving, retirement planning. This is something that's transformed itself, in the U.S. economy and probably abroad too. In the past few decades, defined benefit pension plans are increasingly a thing of the past. If you're going to retire in comfort, you're going to have to save the money. It's increasingly clear. Where do you think we are with that? Are low and moderate income Americans falling behind? And what could be done about it?
Jeff, I think this is a hugely important issue. I don't think that there's enough saving going on for retirement, and it's not happening across the population. So there's a lot of saving going on at the high end. There's very little saving going on at the middle and bottom, or the bottom of the middle and the bottom. And there are some steps that we have proposed for a number of years that we think would actually help a lot, say auto enrollment in IRAs. We know from behavioral studies that if people are put into an IRA, unless they choose to opt out, more of them stay in than if they have to choose to go in. Now, that would require legislation, but we think that is something that we should keep pushing for, and the earlier people start to save, the better off they're going to be when they retire. Something that we can do on our own that the president announced in the State of the Union, and I had the privilege to travel with him to Pittsburgh when he announced it in detail, is something called MyRA. It's going to be a kind of savings bond instrument where an individual will sign up at the workplace to have a withholding, $25 to start an account, minimum of $5 a pay period to be in it, and it's going to be a safe and secure and simple way to get started on saving. You know, a lot of people are afraid that if they put money into a retirement account, they won't be able to get access to it if they need it, or it might go down in value. Well, the beauty of this is the principal will be guaranteed, just the way federal retirees who save money through the federal retirement system have a bond fund that's guaranteed. It will be simple. It'll be a checkoff at work to participate. And people will be able to get access to their money if they need it in the future because it'll be set up like a Roth IRA where you can get your principal out at any time. I don't think starting with $25 a month, $5 a pay period, it's going to be enough for people when they retire.
Probably not.
But we do know that when people get started, they usually increase their retirement savings as they proceed through their career. These will max out at $15,000. And one of the beauties of it is that it's not of a lot of interest to kind of private asset managers to have accounts that start out at $25 until they grow to a certain size. It will be naturally a transition into the marketplace for IRAs and in the private sector. And I think it fills a gap where it's not an alternative to employer matched contributions. I wouldn't encourage anyone to stop at it. But there's not a lot of space for the starter saver. And I think getting people started is critically important. If you get started when you're in your 20s and you save until you retire, without a doubt, you're going to be better off when you retire.
I think we're just about at the end. Is there time for one more, or are we good? One more. So I have a couple of questions here about Social Security reform, entitlement reform. In 2 minutes, I know it's hard to take on that weighty topic. But are there first steps? I mean, is entitlement reform possible? I mean, I think we've given up on the idea of there being some kind of a grand budget deal that might address that. But where do you see?
Well, first, I think we have to look at what's happening right now. When you look at entitlement reform, obviously there's health care and there's retirement.
Yep.
Health care is the hardest analytically to understand what you can do that will make a difference because it's private and public planners alike have had a challenge in that regard. We're seeing that the Affordable Care Act has had a positive effect on health care costs in this country. It's not the only reason, but we've seen more moderate growth in healthcare costs, and that will have a profound effect if it continues on the long-term cost of Medicare and Medicaid. So I think we ought not to start from the notion that we haven't done something pretty big in the last few years. We've taken the most dramatic action to change how we handle healthcare in this country, certainly in a generation, arguably since Medicare. The biggest step, but even bigger than possibly. I think, Social Security, the president has spoken to on many occasions. There is going to be a need at some point to have a conversation where we, in the context of protecting the core system that people rely on today, we have a balanced and fair approach that doesn't put people in a place where they lose the access to what they've relied on, and I don't think the environment is right now for that conversation. Even the small step that the president has talked about in terms of the past, we have to do it in connection with a broader discussion of fiscal policy until there's a discussion where tax revenue and entitlement savings come together. It's hard to see that getting done, but I also don't think there's an urgency to doing it today or tomorrow. It can't be put off for 20 years.
Yeah.
But if you look at where we were at the beginning of this administration, we've cut the deficit more than in half. We're on a path towards having the deficit as a percentage of GDP at a sustainable level for the next decade. And we have a window of time where if we can rebuild the kind of political trust, it will be possible to take on the kinds of issues that have been more challenging in recent years. And if we can make progress on the kinds of things that we were discussing earlier, like infrastructure and skills and immigration, yep. Trust leads to more trust. Mm. And I'm an optimist. I think that there's the next 3 years are a long time, and we're going to get a lot done.
Super. Thank you very much.